At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's probably about time to rethink those New Year's plans, because as usual, it's still the pandemic's economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, December 27th. Good to have you join us. Today, we got an early picture of the all-important holiday sales season. And with the caveat that Omicron could dim the economic outlook as more people choose to stay home, things look pretty decent, for retailers at least. New data show consumers showed up big time, with holiday sales surging 8.5% from last year. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more.
You know all those stories you heard this fall, including here, about snarled supply chains and product shortages? Well, it sounds like a lot of you were listening. Steve Sadoff is former CEO at Saks, who's now with MasterCard. He says it wasn't the doorbusters driving holiday shoppers as much as fear of empty shelves.
They were out shopping earlier, even though the discounts weren't as deep as you might have seen in prior years.
The MasterCard Spending Pulse report showed those early birds helped drive the strongest growth in holiday shopping in 17 years, much of it online. The largest surges took place in apparel, up almost 50% from last year, and jewelry, up more than 30%.
We are convinced we're going to get out of our sweatpants for New Year's.
Greg Portell is a retail analyst at consulting firm Kearney.
We're starting to adjust our consumer habits in order to find those little luxuries.
The hunt for those little luxuries drove the oddest purchase on Portell's own holiday shopping list this year.
My daughter loves cow paintings. So she got a 3-foot by 3-foot picture of a cow,
which Portell bought in person. Despite the explosive growth of online shopping during the pandemic, most of our purchases still take place the old-fashioned way. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
That old-fashioned way, as in shopping in a real-life store. But what happens when those real-life store employees get sick? Today, the CDC shortened the isolation period for folks who get COVID by half. The agency says people without symptoms can safely be around others 5 days after their positive test results, replacing previous guidance that said people who test positive should stay home and isolate for a full 10 days. Still, with Omicron on the rise, some industries are facing another wave of staffing disruptions. Marketplace's Savannah Maher reports.
Juan Padro owns 12 restaurants in the Denver area. In the weeks before Christmas, he says each had workers test positive for COVID.
We had a situation where a kid threw an ugly sweater party in a one-bedroom apartment.
Staff from three of Padro's restaurants were on the guest list.
Now they're COVID, no kidding.
With those workers isolating and others unwilling to come in for fear of getting infected, Padreau temporarily closed several of his restaurants.
This is probably, from a staffing perspective, been the most challenging time that we've had.
Omicron will disrupt staffing in more than just the service industry, says Glenn Mays with the Colorado School of Public Health.
It does have the potential to make healthcare workforce shortages even more acute.
In other industries, Mays says some employers might pressure sick workers to come in anyway, or workers might make that call on their own because they can't afford the time off.
Those kind of trends could be very problematic in terms of facilitating the spread of this virus in workplace settings.
At the start of the pandemic, temporary government support helped keep workers safe and businesses afloat, says Aaron Sojourner, a labor economist at the University of Minnesota.
So basically, yeah, like taking the expense off of the business's books and making it part of a social insurance.
Now that federally mandated COVID sick leave and related tax incentives have expired, he says businesses are on their own. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a holiday gift for the markets. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The current wave of COVID is bringing back unfortunate echoes of the past. In crowded hospitals, tough conversations with friends and families, and in the economy. Businesses are having to make decisions about whether to stay open. Ports are having trouble keeping staff levels up, so imported products are backing up. And airlines are canceling hundreds and hundreds of flights. The travel industry has been one of the hardest hit by the pandemic. Marketplace's Justin Ho reports on what that industry has learned from previous waves and how it's bringing that knowledge to bear as Omicron spreads.
Travel agent John Decker has learned that there's a lot of demand for what he does.
Since you and I have been talking, my phone's rang three different times from three different clients.
Decker says he's turned his agency, Surf City Travel, into a 24/7 operation, solving problems like what to do if a flight's canceled or if a car service doesn't show up.
It's somebody testing positive for COVID trying to get on the flight to come to the United States, and what do?
The travel industry has also learned to be more efficient. Analyst Dan Waslick at Morningstar says hotels are using mobile apps for check-in.
Hotels are also getting rid of some things such as breakfasts. Housekeeping is now kind of on a per-request basis.
Cruise lines are adjusting itineraries on the fly and isolating passengers who test positive, says analyst Henry Hartevelt at Atmosphere Research Group. He says airlines are better at rescheduling flights.
An airline is more likely to cancel flights that either are less fully booked or are operating on routes that have more flights scheduled.
Hartevelt says it's unlikely that airlines will require domestic passengers to take COVID tests or get vaccinated. One reason, he says airlines will likely look at their unvaccinated customers
and say, we don't want to lop off potentially 14% of our customers and lose 14% of our revenue.
Hartevelt says he hopes the travel industry will continue to learn from this latest surge in case other variants emerge in the future. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
During the height of the pandemic, many people chose to pick up and move out of major cities and into the suburbs. But there are other longer-term migration trends happening as well. For example, 9 out of the 10 U.S. cities with the largest Black populations saw steep declines in those numbers over the last 20 years, according to the latest census data. And that migration affects the culture, politics, and the economy of the communities left behind. Politico's Recast, a newsletter covering race, identity, and politics, recently launched a series about this called The Next Great Migration. I spoke to Politico's Bracton Booker about just what he's seeing in the numbers.
the census figures are coming out earlier this year. We were just kind of crunching the numbers and just trying to see what kind of stories could we tell. And the thing that kept coming up was like, where are all these Black folks going? We're seeing just a steep decline. And when we started looking at just, okay, what are some of the major cities that have a huge Black populations? So many cities had lost population over the course of 20 years because we wanted to look back over the course of a generation here. And so we started digging in and tried to come up with some really good stories. And Chicago is where we landed first.
Okay, I'm going to circle back to Chicago in a minute, but you're calling this the next great migration. Why is that?
It's sort of like a Blaxit, right? An exodus of Black Americans from cities that were sort of these beacons of the original Great Migration from the 1920s. So right around when World War I began and the industries in cities were starting to pick up production, those were like beacons for Black Americans trying to find a better life and trying to escape Jim Crow era laws. So they were moving from the Jim Crow South to the North in many cases, or into the Midwest. So what we're seeing now is people are moving away, trying to find better lives. And that's why we called it the next great migration, because we are trying to figure out where these broad populations of African Americans are moving to.
What has been your takeaway so far about why Black residents are migrating from major cities to the suburbs?
Well, it's not just the suburbs, but that is certainly a place where they are going. What we're seeing, though, is that, you know, instead of Black folks moving from, you know, one major city to another because of economic reasons, we're seeing that folks are moving sometimes to the southern parts of the country where it's warmer, yes, than Chicago, or for some of the cities in the Midwest.
It's very cold also, in Chicago.
It is. But you're also seeing that folks have a lot more options. They can work from home now that this is part of the culture that has kind of been brought on by the pandemic. And so people are not forced to live in cities as much anymore. And so they're picking up and choosing places to go that they can provide a better life for their family.
Yeah, but that remote work thing is a pandemic trend. And you're talking about a trend over 20 years. What happened in the last two decades that made Black people, in many cases, want to leave the city?
Well, a lot of it really has to do with disinvestment, right? A lot of promises are made by politicians that they're going to invest in making sure streets are paved, making sure that neighborhoods are safe. And when politicians' rhetoric does not match up with the reality, when the campaign promises don't come to fruition, those that have the opportunity to leave are deciding like, hey, should we try to make it work in this city that we've called home, my family has called home for generations? Or do we need to pick up and just try something new? We can always come back home, right? We can always come back to the city that we have roots in. But if we want to try to, you know, get to the next rung of economic security, maybe we need to just pick up and try something else in a different city. And I think that's what you're seeing.
Your first focus in this series is Chicago. Tell me a little bit more about why you picked that city.
Well, Chicago is a microcosm of a lot of cities, and it really told the story of what's going on with demographic shifts in this country, right? And so what we're seeing on the local level is how the changes in demographics are really impacting politics. So we see on the city council that there is this battle between the Black caucus and the Latino caucus over redrawing the Chicago district map. You know, the Black caucus is trying to hold on to a number of seats, and the Latino caucus has grown. And actually, they will get one or two more districts, and they think they should be getting more. And so there is this power struggle playing out right now about who gets control over the city, redrawing of the city maps for the next 10 years, and who gets to pick who gets to represent those people in those districts.
Politico's Bracton Booker, and the series is called The Next Great Migration and is going to run into next year. Bracton, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
they were playing together with friends or even meeting strangers.
Hopefully some wholesome virtual connections. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 351 points, nearly 1%, to close at 36,302. The Nasdaq added 217 points, just shy of 1.4%, to end at 15,871. And the S&P 500 picked up 65 points, also just shy of 1.4%, to finish at 4,791. And on this Three Friend Chen's third day of Christmas, we can report that inflation has hit the gifts listed in the classic holiday song. Their cost is up 5.7% over 2019, according to PNC Bank's Christmas Price Index. The index skipped last year for obvious reasons. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.47%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. If you enjoyed any kind of meat dish this holiday weekend, thank the workers in meat processing plants, many of whom have struggled through waves of outbreaks throughout the pandemic. Those outbreaks have shut down major factories or slowed production in many places, affecting food supply lines across the country. That means more ranchers are turning to local butchers for processing, but that's pushed wild game butchering to the side, frustrating hunters. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports.
The building is old, but the processing room is clean and neat. A few animal carcasses hang near the wall. A worker in a white coat, hairnet, and face mask starts a machine that vacuum seals a steak into plastic packaging. I'm at Northwest Premium Meats, a USDA-certified meat processing plant in southern Idaho. Elliot Tolbert is the manager.
You've got them running packaging and labeling down there. All of our guys will cut on the table here. Big grinder and mixer here.
Up in his office, he says the relatively small company saw a massive influx of business during the pandemic. People buying meat and needing animals to be processed.
Like 120% increase or better, you know, 200%.
Tolbert says it accelerated a trend of people seeking out local meat shops. But it's hard to grow when there are labor shortages. Tolbert's shop did expand from around 10 people before the pandemic to 18, but even that wasn't enough for him to keep processing wild game like deer or elk, which they did after hours in the past. It's also usually not as profitable as livestock.
When it came down to it, it was just nobody wanted to do it. We didn't have the manning. Everybody was already running ragged. So we 86'd it.
But hunters kept calling, looking for anyone to process their animals.
I know guys that are doing it on the weekends, and a couple of them have told me stories of, yeah, you know, they brought it over to my house, or I went over to their house to help them cut it up, and it was bad.
The meat spoiled. Get Your Meat LLC in nearby Boise only processes wild game. Andy Donsero is the owner. Even he wasn't able to keep up with demand.
In October, we were averaging 110 phone calls daily. We just stopped answering the phone, unfortunately. We didn't know what to do.
This isn't just an Idaho problem. Christopher Young directs the American Association of Meat Processors. He says they've had members all around the country setting aside wild game processing because the livestock business is booming.
You know, we've even had guys that do wild game that have upped their prices to kind of try to price themselves out of it to slow it down, and it hasn't slowed it down.
But that puts hunters in a tough spot, especially if they don't have the space, time, or know-how to process game themselves. Even if you got the first deer or elk of the season, you might have had a long wait for processing. Jason O'Neill in Helena, Montana, got a mule deer buck on October 23rd, opening day for hunting in that area.
By about 9:30 opening morning, I already had it gutted and ready to start the trudge out to pack it out of the forest.
He brought it to a local butcher that night, and it still took more than 2.5 weeks to get processed. They cited staffing shortages. Someone I know, Sven Berg, got a white-tailed doe in North Idaho last season and couldn't find a single place to process it locally. He ultimately had to drop it off and later pick it back up in Spokane, Washington, about 40 minutes from where he was staying with his dad. And the cost was high, too.
When we got the deer back, it was like a week and a half later. And I mean, it was like close to $300. And we were just like, what are we doing?
That's more than three times what he'd paid just a few years ago. If it happens again this season or in the future, Berg says,
we're just going to say, you know what? Let's just bite the bullet. Let's lay a bunch of tarps out.
Berg and his dad will sharpen their own knives and butcher the animals themselves. In Boise, Idaho, I'm Madeline Beck for Marketplace.
With lots of folks staying in during the pandemic, more people than ever are gaming to escape from the real world for a bit. And 2022 is a gaming anniversary of sorts, marking 50 years since gaming consoles first came on the market. Jana Arbanas is Deloitte's telecom, media, and entertainment sector leader. And while consoles have always been a gateway for escape, I asked her how they've changed over the years.
I remember using video consoles myself as a child, and the experience that my own son today can achieve in the gaming consoles today is vastly different in terms of that immersive experience, the ability to connect with other players throughout the game, a highly produced experience that really draw the player into an entire world that is virtual.
And how has the pandemic and the lockdowns of it for those who were able to stay home affected the gaming industry?
Well, more people are gaming than ever before. In fact, we're predicting that there'll be about 900 million console gamers by the end of 2022.
Wow.
Gaming was an important way for people to feel connected because they were playing together with friends or even meeting strangers, especially when we were navigating those periods of lockdown. And that preference really hasn't subsided.
Taking that historical view again, over the last 50 years, how has the business model of gaming consoles changed?
Yeah, the business model has changed drastically. Historically, we would have purchased a title one time and played that title repeatedly. Now it's more of a subscription base where you're paying on a monthly basis, and then that gaming experience evolves. So-called chapters are released over time so that it's an evolving game that transforms. And on top of that, people are purchasing virtual goods, things to practice. caps put on, skins, or even things to help you compete. So there is a huge amount of commerce that's actually happening. In fact, some people are predicting that digital fashion will hit $50 billion in 2022.
Wow. And speaking of money, what kind of money are we talking about in the console industry at this point? And is the money in the consoles or is it in these add-ons?
So we are predicting that the console market will generate $81 billion in 2022, which is up 10% from 2021. And when you really dig into that number, the vast majority of the revenue is actually derived from the subscriptions, from the software experience, from the actual gaming, as well as the perhaps in-game purchases that you're thinking of. So that's about $59 billion of the $81 billion coming from the software sales.
We are still experiencing this global chip shortage. How much will that affect what you're predicting for the console market heading into the new year?
Absolutely. Supply chain disruption has continued to be, I would say, a real challenge for all consumer goods and gaming consoles as well. So gaming consoles are absolutely in high demand and short supply. So it's likely, I think we would even see higher growth if it weren't for the supply chain challenges that we're experiencing this year, that growth will continue as we head into 2023.
Ideally, we will eventually see an end to this pandemic and people will start to go out more. Do you anticipate gaming keeping up this momentum once people are able to more safely be out and about?
It will be really interesting to see what happens. At the beginning of the pandemic, we did our digital media trend survey. We learned that people were spending more time gaming. And when we checked in with people a few months ago, we found that most people were spending still more time in online entertainment. So I do believe that gaming is here to stay. I think that many people will continue to keep that experience as part of their overall entertainment that they spend time on.
Jana Arbanes is Deloitte's telecom, media, and entertainment sector leader. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Kimberly.
While we are on the topic of things we spent time on this year, we want to know about the stories that shaped the way you thought about the economy. Take the Marketplace year-end poll at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, action movie fans were seemingly undeterred by the surge in cases this weekend, or just that committed. The Sony and Marvel movie Spider-Man: No Way Home became the first movie released during the pandemic to cross the $1 billion mark at the box office, according to The Hollywood Reporter. No Way Home certainly seemed to know how to show customers the way back to theaters. All right, we've got to go, but not without your Monday moment of economic context. A few more numbers on all those travel problems Justin was talking about earlier. According to FlightAware, which tracks this kind of thing, when you tally up the numbers for trips into, out of, and within the U.S., airlines have canceled about 4,000 flights since Friday. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.